This is Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. We're about to talk about the latest on a new lawsuit challenging the way Wisconsin lawmakers have drawn voting maps. And we want to let you know about another legislative conversation on the Ideas Network. On Monday, the morning show is covering how Wisconsin lawmakers are considering ways to block the government from closing churches and other houses of worship during national emergencies. WPR State Capitol reporter joins the show to explain why Republican state leaders are considering a constitutional amendment. You can hear that on the morning show on Monday. It starts at 7 o'clock here on Wisconsin Public Radio. Now on Central Time, a new lawsuit filed Wednesday aims to redraw Wisconsin's Republican-favored legislative maps. The suit argues that Wisconsin's legislative maps are extremely partisan and that they violate the Wisconsin Constitution. We're talking to a political scientist about what the lawsuit argues and where the case could go from here. And we want to hear from you. The number to call is 800-642-1234. What do you wonder about the process of drawing voting districts or suing over those borders? Do you think Wisconsin's current voting maps are fair? Do you feel represented by our state legislature? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. Our guest to navigate this is Charlie Jacobs. He's a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, it's good to talk with you.
Good to talk with you.
This new lawsuit claims Wisconsin's maps are unconstitutional. What's the argument?
Well, it's actually a rather broad argument. This is one of those throw a pan of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks, because there are five different approaches that these litigants are taking in the case. One is just a basic argument, as you noted at the top, that these are extreme partisan gerrymands that are creating an unconstitutional advantage for the Republican Party and for Republican candidates. The second is that there's an equal protection clause, a state equal protection clause violation. That is that the state is treating one group of people as superior and another as inferior. And that way you have an imbalance in the power that each voter has. There's also a free speech issue that's being raised, a free association issue being raised, and just one regarding the issue of free and open government for people under the state constitution. So there's a lot there that the court will have to grapple with if they decide to take this case under their original jurisdiction. But I think that's strategic to try to see whether or not the court is amenable to any of the arguments that are being offered.
And when you're talking about original jurisdiction, you're talking about how the Supreme Court of the state can choose to take a case from the very beginning. It does not have to go through all of the lower courts to get to them.
That's exactly correct. So we're kind of, this is the game of Monopoly. You're skipping every space and going right to go and collecting your constitutional outcome that you want. That's the kind of approach that they're taking here. Now, it's not clear that the court will take this case under original jurisdiction. In their pleadings, they make a relatively strong argument for this, but there's this discretionary element to what the court gets to do. And because some of the facts in question have not yet been resolved, often courts will say, well, let's let a lower court resolve the issue of the factual record before we take it, because we're not really capable of doing that as the Supreme Court, that typically is only reviewing things on appeal.
What kind of facts can you point to that aren't yet resolved?
Well, I just think it's a question about the makeup of the districts, some of the questions about how they're organized and whether or not they would be considered contiguous. And that is whether or not we have a full block of geography that's being represented by one person instead of sort of the crazy quilt that we see a little bit around the state. So there are a number of issues regarding whether or not people have been harmed. These issues often have to get resolved before the court is going to jump into these kinds of issues.
Well, Republican lawmakers are criticizing the timing, too. Advocates filed it one day after the latest Supreme Court justice was sworn in. Wisconsin voters elected Janet Protasiewicz, which tips the balance of the court, that seventh person, to be more liberal. What do you think of that strategy?
Well, it's not unexpected. You run one of the most expensive campaigns for a state Supreme Court judge ever. And I think you can expect if you win that people are going to bring cases they think are going to be treated favorably by the new membership on the court. Certainly, conservatives and Republicans would do the same thing if the conditions were changed. So the timing is not unusual. I think that one of the things that we have to keep in mind that Justice Hagedorn, while certainly has been siding with those who are more liberal on the court, has a history of being somewhat more conservative and Republican. And so it's not as though the 4-3 majority is going to be solid and continuous during the term of this particular court. But it is advantageous for these plaintiffs to bring this case at this time. And they want to do it now because with the impending 2024 elections, if they are successful, they may force the redrawing of these districts. And they're making an argument that some of the senators are going to have to run again, even though their term isn't up, because they're currently occupying districts that are unconstitutional. So they're really trying to shake up the electoral map for the next election. That is a tight time frame to try to get this all done in, especially if it has to go to the lower courts. So the timing had to be quick if they wanted to get this done by the 2024 election in November.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor at St. Norbert College, and we're talking about a new lawsuit that challenges Wisconsin's voting maps. You can ask your questions, give us a call, help us understand how you feel about this at 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. And we've got Andy in Appleton, who is ready to have a conversation with us. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I've been pretty excited about fair voting maps. I know the Wisconsin Coalition on Fair Maps proposed to Green Bay some different maps, and they took about 2 minutes to totally reject it. It wasn't appreciated, the effort at all. And I know Iowa has got fair voting maps, but they still vote overwhelmingly one way. And I've seen that in Wisconsin, too, so that even if we've fixed the voting districts and have fair maps, you still have this big trend going on in Wisconsin, which is rural Wisconsin still is overwhelmingly red. And still flies the Let's Go Brandon flags, and the cities, urban areas are overwhelmingly blue. So that, even with fair voting districts, that trend is still going to exist in Wisconsin. And the last thing I was hoping to have someone address for me is, how come Wisconsin's got 4.5 million eligible voters, but only 3.5 million registered voters? That's a pretty big gap.
All right, Andy, thanks so much. I'm not sure, Charlie, I don't know if that last question is really within the scope of what we're talking about here. Do you know?
I mean, the short answer really is no one is compelled to register to vote or to vote, unlike, say, the nation of Australia, where you are required to show up and vote by law. It's a misdemeanor if you don't. People can choose to register or not. We don't have automatic registration. Certainly that could be effective if we automatically registered everybody who was qualified to vote, but that's not something that the public has, and politicians quite honestly, have embraced because it makes outcomes a little bit more ambiguous. When you know who the registered voters are, you have a tendency to know how they're likely to vote, and you can plan accordingly in your campaigns. It's a wild card when you have a bunch of new voters enter the fray, and that makes especially incumbent politicians very nervous. His first point.
Exactly.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's what I was going to ask about, to Andy's first point, just about the nuance that even if we have what he would consider fair maps, he sees the communities that are urban versus rural going in different political directions.
And that's true. And certainly, I think even a better example might be something like the state of Kansas or the state of Missouri, where you really do have two centers of Democratic strength, which are in the more urban areas. And you can try all sorts of gymnastics to draw maps that are quote unquote fair, but you're still going to have a block of red in the middle of these states where there isn't a larger urban population that tends to vote more democratically. And so that would be a problem here in Wisconsin too. But the difficulty is that we'll take the 2018 elections in the state where 53% of the legislative vote was in the direction of Democrats. And Democrats only won 36 of 99 assembly seats. There are a lot of Democrats, and yes, they are splayed across the state. But when you purposefully draw districts in a way which does one of two things, cracking or packing. And so cracking means we take a locus of Democrats or Republicans or any group, and you crack them and put them in various districts, diminishing their power to effectively compete for a seat. Packing is, well, you grab a whole bunch of like-minded individuals, put them into one district, often very oddly shaped. And while they win one seat, they empower the other districts around them to win in the alternative political direction. And so those two effects can be really problematic. And so when we talk about fair maps, we're just talking about drawing districts where you are creating more competition. It's not that Democrats or Republicans will win. It just creates more competition. That may have the effect of diminishing polarization in the United States, because you have to actually start to think about bargaining and compromise and being a little bit more centric in order to win your race, rather than just rolling to Election Day because all of your voters are either Democratic or Republican.
Your cracking and packing explanation might apply right now. We've got Agnes in La Crosse who has a question for us. Hi, Agnes.
Hey, here's my question. I'm in La Crosse, which is always Democratic, and we're packed in here pretty good. I'm curious if in the last election for the Assembly and for the Senate, were there more Republican votes cast in total or Democratic votes? Because, I mean, there were more Democratic votes cast for Protasiewicz. There were more Democratic votes cast for Evers twice. I'm curious, if you just look at the votes cast, did more Democrats vote? It's just that they were cracked.
Agnes, thank you so much for that question. What do you know about this, Charlie?
So I don't have off the top of my head that breakdown. So, and the best way to look at it is, again, when we're talking about Assembly seats and Senate seats, about the votes cast in the legislative elections. I don't have that off the top of my head. And,
sure.
And of course, one of the difficulties in this state is because you don't have to register as a Republican or a Democrat, and we have open primaries, it's often really hard to determine what percentage of the public considers themselves as a political identification as either a Democrat or a Republican. So that's a little bit hard to divine. And of course, since we don't join political parties like we would, say, the Elks Club, you know, you can change your mind anytime you want to. You can bounce from one party to the other. So it's this moving target. But 3 of 5 statewide races went to the Democrat. So it seems like there was a preference in the Democratic direction. Again, the last Supreme Court decision or race went to someone who was considered more liberal and a Democratic candidate, even though it's nominally nonpartisan. But this state does have and exhibits packing and cracking. That is, we are trying to, whoever's drawing the maps is trying to create opportunities for the Republicans to win. And so they are trying to find pockets of Republicans and Democrats to put together or break apart in a way that creates this disadvantage. So right now, the Senate has a veto-proof majority and only 2 votes away in the Assembly for that. And so when you look at a state where, as you note, Agnes, you know, Evers has won twice and we've had some landslides for Democratic or liberal candidates, it seems odd that the state legislature is so overwhelmingly one party. And so that's the difficult issue here. And this is the issues that's being raised in this particular lawsuit.
We're talking with law and politics expert Charlie Jacobs about a new lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's Republican-favored legislative maps. Taking your calls along the way at 800-642-1234. This conversation continues next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina, talking with Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We're going over a new lawsuit that seeks to redraw Wisconsin's current voting maps, arguing that our current maps are unconstitutional. And Charlie, we've seen lawsuits over these same maps before. What is different about what we've seen this week?
So in my mind, what's different about this particular lawsuit is the strategy that the plaintiffs are taking. When you read this, although there are some mentions of federal case law and the United States Supreme Court, the focus of this case is almost exclusively on provisions within the state constitution and state law and state practice. And that matters because over the last several decades, the United States Supreme Court has been reluctant to the point of ignoring all pleas to end gerrymandering. And it's on a principle related to whether or not there's an actual case or controversy. And there is a doctrine at the United States Supreme Court level that says, If we deem this to be a political question, that is something to be resolved by the political branches and not through legal means, we're not going to decide the case. And so that's why in the past, even cases from Wisconsin have been dismissed in one form or another, because they won't tackle the issue. And this is important because what the court is saying is, how are we supposed to determine what percentage of Republicans or Democrats are supposed to be in a district? It's beyond our capacity. So I think what the plaintiffs figured in this case was, it's kind of a loser of a case if we take it to the federal court. So what we're going to do is focus exclusively on state issues. That way the federal courts won't or can't get involved because it's exclusive to the sovereignty of Wisconsin and not to any issues of federal law or the federal constitution. So this is going to be a really interesting case because there's sort of very little wiggle room to appeal this to what many consider a very conservative Republican United States Supreme Court. And now with a more liberal leaning state court, there might be some room for them to actually dismantle what they perceive to be unconstitutional gerrymanders at the state level.
What arguments can Republicans make to defend these maps that work in their favor?
Well, I think one of the ones that they're going to make is that in the Johnson series of cases that happened right after this post-2020 census was that the previous court made arguments about the simplest way to resolve the dispute between the governor and the legislature when Tony Evers rejected and vetoed the map created by the Republicans. They went to the state Supreme Court, which resolved the issue. And so I think what they're going to argue is we've resolved this issue before. The court offered an alternative, which was this approach to create sort of the least change possible from the 2011-2012 maps. And so I think what they're going to say is precedent should lead us to retaining these maps until the next census in 2030. And of course, the argument against that will be you're just entrenching your power. And since you'll be in power because of these unfair maps in 2030, that will just perpetuate into the future. And we will never have maps that, as Andy characterized, as fairer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for taking us through some of the background and kind of the process judicially that we have gone through to actually wind up with these maps in the first place, because that was also debated back and forth. We are talking with Charlie Jacobs about a new lawsuit filed to redraw Wisconsin's voting maps, and we're taking your calls. We've got Bruce in Cumberland on the line. Hi, Bruce.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I had caught a statistic on NPR a while ago about marijuana legalization, and over 60% of Republican voters want that legalization. And when it came around to a vote, the Republican-held legislature disenfranchised their constituents in that decision. We're also Wisconsinites first. They just tried to do it with education funding. So they hold their own people hostage. That would be clear to me that they would hold the blue side hostage. I think that makes it very difficult for me to be a Republican in this state.
Bruce, thank you for sharing that. I want Charlie to be able to weigh in on this idea that gerrymandering overly partisanly is leading to disenfranchisement, not just for the other party, but also for your same constituents.
Well, and it goes to a deeper Democratic debate about, you know, small d Democratic debate about what representatives are supposed to do. Are they supposed to sort of serve a delegate function where they're reflexively meeting the demands and needs of constituents? Or are they supposed to take an approach where they instead are trying to use their own best judgment to the benefit of the public, whether or not the public likes it or not? It's kind of like, you know, forcing a kid to take castor oil when they don't want to. And the argument would be from the state legislature, well, we've seen the data, we understand the dynamics of legalizing marijuana, so even though you may want it, it's not a prudent approach to take. And so it depends on your approach. Do you want them to have this sort of delegate function, or do you want them to be in some ways supervisory over our own wants and needs to make sure that the right choice, in air quotes, is being made? And so, you know, that's often a personal decision by a legislator, and we have to rely on the public to make the choice about whether or not they're sufficiently meeting the needs of the public. And, you know, Bruce is right. This is a conundrum of any Democratic polity. We have to wonder about how we're being represented.
Mm-hmm. Charlie, this is a brand new lawsuit, but you mentioned that there is a really specific window of time if this might apply in 2024. What is the timeline for something like this moving through the judicial system?
Well, we're going to have to wait first and foremost to see whether or not the court is going to take this under its original jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And if it does, but there are facts that need to be resolved, there are methods by which they can engage actors to help create the factual record. So that will take some time. And then, of course, there will be hearings before the court. Now, if they reject original jurisdiction, well, it's going to have to be refiled, and we're going to have to go through the process of fact-finding and appeals. And so it's unlikely that you're going to see that before the 2024 election to give the legislature or the courts time to draft new maps. So this may extend into midterm elections in 2026 and beyond. So this could drag out a while. There's no guarantee that there's going to be an immediate resolution of this issue.
Does the Wisconsin Supreme Court have any sort of deadline?
Not really.
Right.
I think the liberals on the court are very likely energized with their new majority, and they may be very willing to take some of these cases that have been percolating but have not arrived on their doorstep because of the hesitance to bring it to a conservative court. So for all we know, they're going to stomp on the gas pedal and go, but that also might create some legitimacy issues with the court that they look far too partisan. So they may take at least some time to determine how they're going to act on this matter.
Got it. Charlie, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That was Charlie Jacobs, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We talked with him about a new lawsuit challenging Wisconsin's voting maps and how it could affect future elections. And now we'll have to wait and see. This is Central Time. And coming up after the news, we talk to the author of a new memoir about growing up as a girl in a rural town in Arkansas and how small town rural life affects women and girls beyond her hometown and into Wisconsin. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, many people enjoy a glass of wine once in a while, but it can be hard to navigate the varieties and the regions to find what works for your taste. For Food Friday, we've got a wine expert ready to help. That is ahead. First, we're talking about what growing up in small-town America is like for girls and women. And when we think about that, we want to think about how rural communities affect the health and life trajectories of girls as they grow older. And you are part of this conversation. So join us now to share your experiences. The number is 800-642-1234. We're wondering, how do you think growing up in a small town has influenced the trajectory of your life? What do you see that's changed from when you were growing up? Or maybe what remains the same a few years, a few generations later? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Just a few years ago, life expectancy dropped among the least educated white Americans. It happened between 2014 and 2017, and it was especially significant for women who didn't graduate from high school. They were dying on average 5 years earlier than women the generation before them. When our guest saw this data, she thought of the place where she grew up and of her childhood best friend, whose life had turned out to be very different from her own. Monica Potts is a senior politics reporter for 538. She's also the author of The Forgotten Girls, a memoir of friendship and lost promise in rural America. Monica, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Monica, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Clinton, Arkansas. It's a small town of between 2,500 and 2,600 people on the southern edge of the Ozark Mountains in northern Arkansas. It's a really small community, really remote, and really religious. So it's a unique place in American life.
Is it so unique that you feel like your experiences there really only apply to people in that area? Or do you see this kind of experience really translating across the country?
Oh, I see it translating across the country. I think my personal part of the reason I wanted to come back here and write about my experiences in this small town is that I see some of the challenges and some of the experiences happening here in Clinton, happening everywhere. There's, you know, small towns are losing a lot of their younger people. Women in small towns are losing life expectancy. It's something that's hitting rural America across the country. So I wanted to sort of use this, my particular experiences, to shed a light on what's happening all across rural America.
You don't have to get too far into your book, The Forgotten Girls, to read that you describe Clinton with the phrase overwhelmingly evangelical and Protestant. What effect did that have on you, and in particular, you know, other girls growing up in that community?
Mm-hmm. We were growing up in the 1980s and 1990s here. And during that time, there was a big push for abstinence-only sex education, for a movement called True Love Waits that pushed people to think about, or pushed young girls to think about their marriages down the road. And so we had a really traditional expectations for our upbringing. We thought of ourselves as future wives and mothers first. There was a really strict taboo against having, you know, having sexual relationships with boyfriends before you got married. And that really kind of changed how we thought about our potential futures. We were supposed to be helpmates for our future husbands. We thought about our careers as secondary to becoming mothers. And I think that kind of traditional conservative outlook on life affected the way we thought of what our futures could look like, for sure.
Did you see that beyond people who were particularly religious? Was it really community-based?
Yeah, it was really community-based. I myself didn't go to an evangelical church, but I still felt that those expectations were around, and it was the way that we interacted with each other in school. It shaped the way that some of our teachers thought of our futures, and we saw that happening with my science teacher in one class told us that women could do the dishes better because they had an extra layer of fat on their skins, and that being a teacher was a great career for a woman because they could have the same time off as their children and while they were in public schools. So there was this kind of expectation that we would sort of design our lives around being wives and mothers.
The expectation, right? Not the choice, that might be something that a woman might decide for herself is important to her, but that was what you were supposed to do.
Mm-hmm. That's what you were supposed to choose. It was really one option. And when you only have one option, it's not really a choice.
Mm-hmm. Monica Potts is an author and a reporter. She wrote a new book about how she sees politics and religion, education and poverty influencing girls growing up in rural America. There's time for your story. Are you a woman who grew up in a small town? Tell us what it was like. You can call in at 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. I do want to go next, Monica, to a woman named Darcy. This book is about your life, your childhood friend. Darcy's life is also front and center here. Tell us a bit about Darcy and your friendship with her.
Mm-hmm. Darcy and I met in first grade when I moved back to Clinton, which is my hometown, from a smaller town elsewhere in the county. We met right away. She was really a friendly, outgoing girl, and she wanted to be friends with everybody. And I just kind of immediately became friends with her. Even when we didn't share the same class in school, she would come over to my house on weekends. And I grew up with two younger sisters, and we would make potions in the backyard and in our bathroom and make messes, and we would go on expeditions. We had a big atlas that we would look at and dream about going to a bigger town somewhere, like a town that looked like what we saw on TV, with sidewalks and neighborhoods and places to play. When we were teenagers, we thought of going to concerts, and we really just shared this dream of moving out of Clinton, of going to some bigger place and having some big impact on the world. That was our dream. We stayed close through almost all of high school until we started to drift apart.
We'll get back to the differences and the similarities between your life and Darcy's in just a moment, but we are taking calls at 800-642-1234, and we have Kay in Madison who's ready to join us. Hi, Kay.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have lived both sides of the question. When my parents first moved to Madison from Illinois when I was a toddler, We rented a house, which was a great experience, on a mink ranch going towards Oregon. I think it was on Highway 14. So I went to Oregon Public Schools until I was in the fourth grade when we moved into Madison on the west side. And the one thing I carried with me all of my life from my teachers in Oregon, where there was a lot of farm families, one teacher said, if you don't learn proper English and grammar, people are going to think you're a Yahoo. And I am quite frankly appalled today at the way that people have ruined the English language, especially prepositions like I'm excited for something and him and me.
Kay, thank you so much. And I want to keep the conversation focused on that experience. So I appreciate the fact that you brought that forward. And I also hear Kay speaking to the fact that there are additional expectations for women that you need to seem a certain way to be accepted. And I do think, Monica, that that relates to some of the experiences that you've had too.
Yeah, I think that's right. The expectation that you have to try harder and excel more. And even when you do that, that's just what's expected of you as a woman. You don't necessarily get extra credit or a pat on the back for that. It's just an expectation.
Mm-hmm. Other things, when you think about how women were viewed differently growing up in Clinton or girls growing up in Clinton, what did it feel like to grow up in that small town?
You know, I think there were aspects of it when we were very young that were kind of magical. And I'm sure that that's true in a lot of places, but we had sort of the run of the place. We could run around the neighborhoods near the school that existed on our own, pretty much. We could take expeditions down the old riverbeds in the summer when they were dry. And we could do a lot of things in nature and in a beautiful setting that I think I didn't fully appreciate when I was younger. When I got a little older, though, and I was in the school with the same people who, you know, had known me my whole lives and maybe knew my whole family, it really could feel suffocating at times, because there was this kind of expectation that you were just following in your parents' footsteps, that their destiny would be your destiny. And that was kind of hard to break out of that. And it started to feel claustrophobic when I got older.
We're talking with Monica Potts about her new book, The Forgotten Girls. It tells her story and considers what it's like for girls to grow up in small towns. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did you grow up in a rural town? What was that like for you, going from girl to woman? And how do you think life in small towns affects women and girls? You can call 800-642-1234. There's a line for you there, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue talking with Monica and also learn more about how her friend Darcy's path wound up being very different than Monica's own, along with your story. The conversation continues here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking with author Monica Potts about her book that focuses on girls and women in rural areas of the U.S. We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234 about your experiences growing up as a girl in a rural town, or maybe living in one now. Monica, back to your childhood friend, Darcy. You mentioned that you began drifting apart kind of in high school and moving on from there. You end up going to college at Bryn Mawr. What did Darcy do after high school?
Darcy experienced a setback before high school ended. She found out she wasn't going to graduate because she had missed too many days. And that was really hard for her to take in. She thought she was still doing well in school. She was still making good grades. And so she ended up going to a community college the following year with a GED, but she didn't really stick with it. She dropped out soon after. She moved back to Clinton. Her life after that had a number of tragic setbacks. She developed a substance use disorder. She had two children with someone that she never married. They had a relationship that both of them say wasn't the best relationship for them. And Darcy ended up later going to prison in her life. And that's really when I met back up with her as an adult, was after she was out of prison and she was working to turn her life around.
What did she tell you about her life? How did she describe it?
She described it as a series of hardships and setbacks, but she was always looking forward to getting past her addictions, getting past her setbacks and getting her children back. She has two children. And at the time they were living with her mother, who is their legal guardian. And so she was always really trying to look ahead and look forward. But she thought that she had made her peace with living in Clinton. But I think that staying in Clinton, we both felt and she recognized had been a hardship for her. It hadn't been what she wanted, and it hadn't been what she expected of her life. And I think it set her back to stay in town.
So what do you think made the differences between where you wound up and what Darcy wound up doing?
I think a big difference for me was that my mom, and I talk about this in the book, but she was very determined to see my sisters and I leave Clinton to go to college far away, to try to make our lives elsewhere. She had felt limited by the opportunities presented to her in Clinton. And so she didn't want us to feel those same limits. And she wanted us to feel that the world was available to us and we could do anything we wanted, anywhere we wanted. And I think that that ambition and that support and that push to go somewhere different, to go somewhere new was really good for me. Going to Bryn Mawr College for me was really a fantastic option because they really provided the support and the opportunities that I needed to thrive. And I was very happy there. I think that made a huge difference than trying to stay somewhere closer that might not have had the resources to really support my needs at that time. I think Darcy didn't have that. Her mom thought she would go to college, but didn't expect her to. And so some of that drive was missing.
You talked about the expectations for just how women should be in these rural communities. How have you seen groups of people, entire towns, treat people, especially girls and women who want to leave for school or for other jobs or really for any reason?
Mm-hmm. You know, I had been hoping that my experience was not what girls were still experiencing here now, so many years later. But I spoke to two graduates from my high school from 2019, and they both had sort of related experiences that were very similar to what I had had 20 years before. They were kind of discouraged from looking at colleges or opportunities out of state or far away. They didn't see some kind of career paths like working in a trade available to them. They thought they were only open to boys. They expected to pick a career that would be compensated less well than what boys would have. And they also expected to first and foremost design their career around being wives and mothers. And so I think that the expectations and the norms were very much the same even after 20 years.
Monica Potts is an author and reporter. She wrote a new book about girls growing up in rural areas. There's still time for your story. You can share it with us at 800-642-1234. We've actually got Marcus in Milwaukee who wants to join this conversation. Hi, Marcus. What are you wondering?
Hi. So I guess I grew up in the city in Milwaukee. So I guess my question for you is what similarities and differences did you notice how boys were treated as they were coming up as opposed to girls or the same as girls? And how were women who moved into the community who had grown up somewhere else, how were they treated?
Thank you so much, Marcus. Monica, what do you think about Marcus's question?
It's a really interesting question. I can say that boys growing up were just given a lot more leeway to make mistakes and to kind of figure out who they were. And they didn't have to always strive for perfection or nothing. There was kind of there's just this middle ground that they could trod that I think made it easier for them. I don't really know so much about women who moved into the community, but I can say that women who are considered different or oddballs in any kind of way are treated a little bit like outsiders in the community. So I have seen that.
Thank you so much, Marcus, for your call. We appreciate it. We're still taking calls at 800-642-1234. Monica, you and Darcy, your best friend, both came from working class families. Tell us about Clinton's economy and also how you see economic factors influencing girls as they grow up.
Mm-hmm. Clinton's economy has never really been super vibrant. It was very agrarian before the 60s and 70s. There were a few factories when I was growing up here. There was a chicken processing plant that supported workers, but also supported the people who raised chickens around the area. There was a manufacturing plant for electrical cords. Both of those businesses have left, and the biggest employer is the hospital, or the two biggest employers are the hospital and the school. So there's just not a super big economy. There aren't a lot of large employers. A lot of the people who would have, you know, previously been subsistence farmers or worked in the factories are working at in the low-income service sector. So I think that that really sort of limits the resources people have and limits the connections that they have to anywhere else in the country. It becomes harder to learn about a life that's different from your own and learn about other opportunities and be connected to them in a really realistic way. And I think that affects women more than men because blue collar women and women without educations earn substantially less than their male cohort. So
you moved back to Clinton for several years. What played into that decision?
By the time I was working on the book, I was already traveling back here a lot. And I realized that because I had spent so much time of my youth wanting to leave, I didn't fully appreciate the things that I loved about this place. Some of the culture, the natural beauty, I just wanted to come back and experience it in a way that I thought could give it give me closure and give it the fullest kind of respect that I could. And so I wanted to have a different relationship with my hometown than I had had growing up. And I've been back here for 5 years and it's been challenging and interesting. My mom is still here. I have family members still here and my family has deep roots in the community. So it just feels like home and a place nowhere else quite has.
Yeah, I wonder how that perspective on the town has changed since you moved back or maybe stayed the same in some ways.
I think ultimately it stayed the same. I think for some time it changed a bit. I was really hopeful when I moved back and I thought I could make a life here and that maybe things had changed a lot and the world had opened up in more ways than it had in the 90s for people who lived here. I think I was surprised by how much hadn't changed, how much of the prevailing attitudes hadn't changed and the prevailing culture and some of the ways that women were expected to live their lives were very much the same in a way that was surprising to me.
We talked about Darcy and addiction, which is a universal problem. How is Darcy now? What's she doing?
I'm very happy to say that Darcy has been clean since the end of 2019, kind of the end of the book. She's been stable and working, and she's doing really, really well. So it's been really good to see that change happen.
Incredible. Yeah, that's hard work. You both came from the same place. The whole book is really based on this idea that your lives turned out so wildly differently. After writing it, do you feel like you understand why?
I spent really 5 long years trying to answer that hard, hard question. And I still feel like I don't have a firm answer. But I do feel like one of the things I tried to do was look at each little point in our lives that if they might have gone differently would have set us both on different trajectories. And so I think it's a million little things and a million little decisions and differences and happenings that you might not anticipate at the time could have these long running, long term effects on your lives, but really do. It's really a whole life story.
We've got just 1 minute left, but I want to give you the opportunity. If a girl is listening to this growing up in a small town, what do you want her to know?
The world is bigger than your town and it's bigger than than people might want it to be for you. The world can be as big as you want it to be.
Excellent. Monica, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
You've been hearing Monica Potts, who's the author of the book, The Forgotten Girls, A Memoir of Friendship and Lost Promise in Rural America. Monica is also a politics reporter for 538, and she talked with us about that new book, about her own experiences, and how dramatically different her best friend's life wound up from hers and the factors that contributed to that. Coming up after the news here on Central Time, it is Friday, and that means it's Food Friday. We have a local wine expert with us as our guide to picking your next bottle or glass off a menu or at the store. We're going to learn a lot together, so stay with us. I'm Keeley Voltina in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.